Thank you, bell ringers. Good morning. My name is Tom Phillips. I'm a member of the Unitarian Universalist Fellowship of Manhattan, an evolving religious community. Today our program is going to have to do with food, spirituality, and the world we live in balance. As a prelude to that, our speaker today suggested a reading by the current scholar of Indian environmentalism, Vandana Shiva, and it is titled Annadana, which translates roughly from the Hindi as the gift of food. Please share with me. The food we eat that nourishes us is a gift from the earth, from the sun, from millions of years of evolution. It is also a gift from the farmers, livestock herders, fisher folk who till the land, those who till the land, care for the animals, and harvest fish. When we forget the earth from where we receive our food, food becomes unsustainable. Food is life. Food is not just our vital need, it is the web of life. Food is alive. It is not just pieces of carbohydrate, protein, and nutrient. It is being. It is a sacred being. Because food is the very basis of creation, food is creation, and it is the creator. It is divinity in the context of the way we live. There are all kinds of duties that we should be performing with respect to it. If people have food, it is because society has not forgotten those duties. If people are going hungry, society has moved away from the ethical duties related to food. Okay, let's see what's next. Yes. William is going to help me light the chalice. Okay, so as William lights the flame, we light this chalice this morning grateful for the love that we experience in this beloved community. May the flame light the way for all who seek such abundance. And we are going to have a hymn, opening hymn number 71. Please stand as you're able, number 71 in this book. This book. Yes, very good.
We're just going to do the first three verses.
Please be seated. Okay. Announcements. Sybil wanted me to share that from last night's dinner, we have some wonderful food, still wonderful, hours later, available to take home with a contribution of your choice, of your selection, in money, not animals or other food, right? Okay. Yeah. Any other announcements today? Okay. We will transition next to sharing of our joys and concerns. Michael Oldfather.
I have a concern. Several of you were here last week, and to hear Bryce talk about the limited childhood he lived and how little he had to work with, including toys. And I've been to Bryce's house a number of times, and I haven't seen anything roughly resembling a toy. But in honor of his only childhood toy, I have prepared a replacement for it that is of a little bit higher quality, I think, than he had to work with. A stick and a rock. But notice that the stick is of uniform thickness and straight. The rock is smooth because it spent eons at the bottom of a stream and has been washed, rounded off. Bryce, it's with great pleasure that, in behalf of all of us, I present this stick and stone to you.
Thank you. I appreciate this gesture, and it almost brings tears to my eyes. But if those of you who have been in our house know that I have two big selections of sticks of this sort, and this will be a wonderful addition to my stick collection. Where's the rock?
Larry Weaver, I have a concern and sorrow, sadness. Many of you have probably seen the newspaper accounts of the missing woman from St. George. She was a co-worker in the physics department with me for many, well, was still. And I, in the summer programs that I ran, I absolutely relied on her for the first 15 years or so. She was a wonderful person. And I miss her terribly.
Excuse me. Nell Forrester, I don't know, I haven't seen this morning's paper yet, but Dr. Robert Bob, I can't, Sennett, passed away, and he was a great element in our community and figure, and his wife Kay is in Stony Brook in the early stages of Alzheimer, but sending her friendly and healthy and healing thoughts.
Anna Franklin. Well, I was also going to say something about Bob Sennett. I've been meditating with him for the past few years, every Thursday evening, and he's a great, great friend. He took beautiful photographs and wrote wonderful haiku, and he'll be missed.
Jim Chanteau, some of you may be aware that the Board of Regents has developed a new policy concerning faculty use of social media, and I have been one of the now ex-faculty at K-State, that's been quite concerned about that policy, and I was very happy to see in this morning's paper two articles that suggest maybe things are leaning in the right direction. One was an editorial which said that basically the board had overreached and didn't need even to have this policy since they had checked to see if it was constitutional. It's constitutional. If it's constitutional, why do they need a policy? You know, it's already supported by apparently case law. The other was on the front page where they said that the committee that the board has appointed to review the policy plans to start over, not to revise the policy, but to completely come up with a new policy. I don't think they need any policy, but anyway, maybe things are finally going in the right direction.
I'm sorry, you're trying to tell me something. Okay.
Yes. Jake?
Today?
No. Thursday.
Thursday, I am going to do a science fair.
Okay. Any more? All right, one more.
I'm Ainsley Markle, and I have a joy that it's going to be my brother's birthday on Friday. He's turning 5.
Yeah, all right. Joyce. Okay. Anna. Double dipping, as we say. That's okay.
I know this is not supposed to be announcements, but I want everybody to remember that People's Grocery is having their annual meeting this afternoon at 1:30 at the library. Thank you.
When it comes to co-ops, vote early, vote often, right? Anything else? Okay, today we have a visitor for the, let's see, what's else is first? Sing. Do we sing first? Yes, we do. I knew there was a reason to have that. Okay. Page 69, again in the Unitarian Hymnal. Thank you. Now you may be seated. And our story for all ages will be one that many of us may be familiar with, and it will be read and discussed by Melissa Hammond, the graduate student in English at our own K-State University. Come forward, one and all. I need William for some emergency flame service.
Kids, how many of you have eaten food today? Anybody? Okay, most of you. How many of you have a favorite food? What's your favorite food?
My favorite food is an apple.
Apples? Sounds very healthy. What about you?
Salmon.
Salmon. Oh, good one.
Carrots.
Wow, you all are very healthy eaters. Yeah, you have another favorite food? Okay. You have this? How many of you have also read this book before? The Very Hungry Caterpillar. Yeah, how many of the adults? Yeah, it's a pretty popular book. Well, I thought I'd read this story today because Alex is going to be talking about food, and this is one of the most famous picture books about food, so I thought it was appropriate. All right, I also have someone to help us tell the story. Anyone want to help act it out? All right, yeah, you. There you go. So if you want to just make him pretend to eat, move around, do whatever you want. If you want to share them, you can. All right. The Very Hungry Caterpillar by Eric Carle. All right. In the light of the moon, a little egg lay on a leaf. Yeah, you have it too? All right. One Sunday morning, the warm sun came up, and pop! Out of the egg came a tiny and very hungry caterpillar. You guys see the tiny, tiny caterpillar? Yeah.
And a big, giant sun.
A big, giant sun. He started to look for some food. On Monday, he ate through one apple. That was someone's favorite food. That was yours. But he was still hungry. On Tuesday, he ate through two pears, but he was still hungry. On Wednesday, he ate through three plums, but he was still hungry. Do you guys get hungry? All right. On Thursday, he ate through four strawberries, but he was still hungry. How many strawberries do you think it would take to make you stop being hungry? How many?
Five.
Five? You think five would do it? Four?
Six?
Yeah, well, he only ate four. That's probably why you need some more. All right, on Friday, he ate through five oranges, but he was still hungry. All right, here we go. On Saturday, he ate through one piece of chocolate cake, one ice cream cone, one pickle, one slice of Swiss cheese, one slice of salami, one lollipop, one piece of cherry pie, one sausage, one cupcake, and one slice of watermelon. That night, he had a stomach ache. Yeah, which of these foods have you guys eaten before? All of these? Yeah, he ate a lot. All right, what's he eating now on this page?
A leaf.
The next day was Sunday again. The caterpillar ate through one nice green leaf, and after that, he felt much better. What happened to him here? What's different about him? What's so funny?
He's fat.
Yeah. Look how much he grew. He was just a tiny, tiny caterpillar on this page. And now he's gigantic. All right. Now he wasn't hungry anymore. And he wasn't a little caterpillar anymore. He was a big, fat caterpillar. So what do big, fat caterpillars do? Yeah, they get fat and then they make a cocoon. He built a small house called a cocoon around himself. He stayed inside for more than 2 weeks. Then he nibbled a hole in the cocoon, pushed his way out, and what do you guys think is going to happen?
Butterfly.
Butterfly? All right, let's see. Yeah, there we go. He was a beautiful butterfly. All right, so what did the little caterpillar need to do to get from a tiny caterpillar to a butterfly? Eat through a lot of stuff. That's right. How many of you have grown before? Have you grown? Have you all grown? You guys haven't grown? Most of you, you've probably grown since you were a little baby. Yeah. How do you guys grow? What makes you get taller? Eat healthy food? Yeah. What about you? Yeah, so Alex is going to talk about how important food is and how food changes us and how we make meaning through food. So it's important to remember how the little caterpillar changed so much because of food. Food is very important. All right. Thanks for coming, guys.
Go with you. Go. Okay, let's see if I get this right. Next, we will have the offertory. Enough said. Okay, very good. Our speaker today is Alex Stinson. Alex and his girlfriend, Sarah Lott, moved here within the last year or so. Okay, 2 years, time flies, from Virginia. Alex is a graduate student in the English department, and sort of related to, very much related to the topic today of food and spirituality and culture, he hopes to pursue cultural studies and literature beyond the master's degree. But for today, he has prepared a topic very interesting titled Food, Identity, Community, and Spirituality. Alex.
Thank you, Tom, for the great introduction, and thank you, Melissa, for coming along and helping us put this program together. So as we've been talking about, today's program is about food. I'm here to talk about food and the kinds of stories around food and experiences that create meaning for us as human beings that are integrated into how food operates in our culture as part of communities and part of larger ecologies. Food's meaning permeates our daily lives and surrounds our very action. So there are a lot of places where I could start the discussion about food. After much internal debate, I decided I want to start this exploration of food around a story particular to this community, how Sarah and I ended up discovering UUFM and deciding to join this community. Yes, it started with food. We didn't discover this wonderful community until a year after moving to Manhattan. We arrived here as new transplants looking for a particular model of community. We wanted to recreate the lifestyle which we had started during our undergraduate in Harrisonburg, Virginia, at James Madison University. There, we participated in a particular segment of the community, which I think is best illustrated by profiling a typical weekend. On Friday afternoon, Sarah would make her way to her internship on a local biodynamic farm. Sometimes I would join her, and we'd work the afternoon helping the farmers do the common activities they needed to produce the food on the farm. Then when we would head home, clean up, and head out with our friends to a free wine tasting at the local craft wine, beer, and homebrew shop. Maybe we'd go to a restaurant afterwards. Usually it'd mean coming home and eating. On Saturday, we'd wake up, go to the farmer's market, and later join the crop mob, where we'd help local sustainable farmers do extra physical labor, or if the crop mob wasn't running that weekend, I would make beer. I brew beer in my free time. We would go hiking in the Shenandoahs before finishing the day at one of the many ethnic restaurants in town, whether Ethiopian, Indian, Mediterranean, Mexican food. We loved it all. On Sunday, we might go to the local work cooperative restaurant called The Little Grill, which produced these wonderful locally produced foods and big fat pancakes, great local eggs. And then later that evening, we'd probably share the bottle of wine we bought on Friday with our roommates around a family-style dinner. You're probably noticing a trend. Our social time had a lot of one thing. Yes, food. That's right. What we ate and drank often dictated our social time, filling in our sense of well-being, and tying us to our friends. More than our friends, we were tied to that community and that place, the Shenandoah Valley, through food. We relied on our food culture to draw us out of our apartment and into the community of people that shared not only our ethics and values, but helped us explore the local environment, the local ecology. When we moved here to Manhattan, we tried to recreate that food community. We still do food culture things. We cook. I make beer. Sarah preserves fruit to make jams. We make fermented foods. A variety of herbal teas and remedies are always on our docket of things to do. But when we moved, we still felt a bit disoriented here in Manhattan and had trouble finding the gyms in the community that could help contextualize our interest in food culture. Eventually, we did find places like People's Grocery or Britt's Farm, where Sarah worked briefly, or Paradisa, run by Rhonda Yonke. We ended up buying a local milk share at Christie's Farm. I became active in the local brew club. And Tallgrass is a great community-oriented brewery, really interested in local homebrewers. All of these spaces provided small contextual reminders of our values in which to explore food. But we still struggled to find a community that shared... to share in all of our individual food efforts in Manhattan. We felt more like lone practitioners enduring within a food culture that hadn't yet reached a critical mass of dynamic local food opportunities. We found that a core ethical community that we had in Virginia was missing from our lifestyle. We found that rather suddenly, food communities had moved from the center of our lifestyle in Virginia into something done for our own sake, without concrete implications for our local community, how we interacted with the people around us. So that leads us back to where I started. This last summer, we discovered the community place here, Unitarian Universalist Fellowship in Manhattan. It offers us an ethical context, a community in which we can make ourselves feel meaningfully integrated every week. Sunday services, additional activities such as a spiritual ecology group, all bring us here and create personal meaning. And we were reminded of how a community can make us better individuals, more connected to our surroundings, and really have conversations about the choices we make and the ethics we have. Looking back at the move from Virginia to Manhattan, we see now that what has changed and why we felt a little lost when we first arrived here. In Harrisonburg, the local food community had provided us a similar system of environmental and social and spiritual conversations that helped us meaningfully part of that community. We felt that food provided us a sense of connection to our local environment. Moreover, it reminded us about our core values, interconnectedness, environmental stewardship, fair treatment of other beings, and of course the positive outlook on life that comes from having a welcoming table and a full stomach. I tell you our story not so much to talk about us or to ask you to help change the local food community, though I wouldn't mind. It'd be great. Rather, I tell our story to demonstrate how we found ourselves unintentionally entangled in food communities. We experienced something that many others in the United States are beginning to discover. Hundreds of thousands of individuals are finding themselves absorbed by local food communities and don't realize yet that much of their meaning in life has become connected to what they eat and how they eat it. This local food culture that we found ourselves integrated into offers my talk's first two ways that we understand meaning from our food. The first is a more political meaning, where society spends resources on growing and distributing food, and those resources shape economies. The second is much more individual, where the individual feels touched, what we felt when we were part of the Harrisonburg community, where the exercise of power shapes the individual. Political changes lie in the local food movement's core principles. Activists constantly ask us to consider that instead of buying food from an invisible chain of suppliers at the grocery store, to get to know the people, businesses, places, economies, and ecologies of the food in your local community. In turn, this allows consumers to become better integrated in their local communities and directly make choices about the ethics and environmental impacts of their food. Food and food practices are an activist tool, very political, very kind of a force. But more than its political ends, the movement has created spaces and communities where individuals are asked to find additional meaning in their food. Consumers and local food communities tend to look at food as a holistic concept, involved in every aspect of human life and culture. And instead of allowing it simply to become one of those mundane life necessities where grocery stores and cooking are become burdens, they look towards it as catalyst of well-being in the shape of a community. While I personally think the political meaning is important, I'd like to spend the rest of our time this morning probing how individual meaning makes making surrounds our food and foodways. For the next 30 minutes or so, I want to explore the different ways in which we can envision our food and relate to it, toying with different food concepts that define how we relate through food to ourselves, communities, the environment, and individual spiritual well-being. For me, food offers almost the same connections and understandings that brought me to Buddhism, then to UUFM, and other communities of practice where spirituality is important. Food creates a whole lot of meaning-making. You're probably asking why an English major is talking about food. What do I mean by meaning-making? Well, as part of my graduate research in English literature, I explore how narratives create meaning within our culture. And in turn, how that meaning relies on different rhetorics, different stories, different structures of the information we present to those around us. Recently, I have become interested in food studies, which explores how we represent food information in those narratives. And I hope today to make one of my first attempts in explaining and exploring exactly why I find food and food studies so fascinating. One of the communities where storytelling has become more prominent and I've had a chance to engage in the storytelling is actually the craft brewing movement. I want to share a few examples of how that community, like other food communities, begins to create meaning in their food before moving on to some other experiences and other ways in which we understand food to have meaning. In the last 20 years or so, craft beer has become very popular in number of local as the number of local craft breweries across the U.S. has exploded, opening up a market previously dominated by companies like Budweiser and Coors, these massive corporations that have controlled the market for many, many years. These new breweries are constantly experimenting with hundreds of different styles and flavors of beer, often incorporating local culture or ingredients to ground them in their community. Now, in almost any community in the United States, you can find a local brewery like Tallgrass or Little Apple Brewing Company here in town, which shares a passion for beer with their local community and deliver reach out to that community in sharing the values that they've produced from that in their craft. These breweries sponsor local events, and at any beer or craft brewing event these days, you'll hear the basic story about the process that made that craft industry so successful. They will talk to you about how every beer has three main ingredients: grain, yeast, water, which are all you need to create alcohol. A sugar, the yeast to take the sugar and transform it, and alcohol to provide an environment to do that. And more than that, they'll talk about additional ingredients that add flavor, that add context, that add quality to that beer, like hops or herbs or fruit, that change the characteristics. In doing so, these stories highlight one of the most important forms of meaning-making that we find around food. We invest significant meaning in the processes that make our food and brings that food to the table as something we can eat, something we can enjoy. Usually when we buy processed foods like beer from the grocery store, it's easy to forget why we consume the food in its current processed state. We don't just go out in the field and pick it and eat it there. The food's labeling hardly ever discusses the complex requirements of the original plants or animals to grow and become food, nor how processing transforms it into a more edible product. This same ignorance holds particularly true for beer. The stereotypical American beer drinker, not all, but increasingly fewer American beer drinkers, but stereotypical, drinks the cheapest beers because they offer one end, an alcoholic buzz. Cheap beer is often produced from cheap ingredients, produced in large industrial scales. In this context, industry does with food knowledge what industrial capitalism does best with production processes in general. It breaks the knowledge up into specialist parts, separating from each part in that process, and creating separating each part in that process and creating opaque units that isolate the knowledge from those elsewhere in the chain. Consumers then see the food as disconnected from its actual production processes because they never see the knowledge or the process that goes into creating that. And in doing so, the sense of place, the sense of ecology which surrounds food gets erased. Craft brewing communities rhetorically, so in telling their stories and setting up the information they provide to the community, set their own beers in opposition to the larger industrial beer process. Instead of leaving agricultural and industrial knowledge at the doors, craft beer makers take pride in helping consumers know what they drink and how they produced it. If you ever get a chance to take one of the monthly tours at Tallgrass, where you're probably going to find Sarah and I volunteering, one of the key components of that tour are knowledge stations, where parts of the brewing process and the ingredients that go in are explained. And their involvement in the production of beer, it becomes an integral part of the drink that the tour people on the tour are participating in. By explaining these components, it opens up questions as to what consumers are drinking and how that food and its flavors come to be. Thereby, this creates additional meaning, asking the consumer to look towards the ecological and community-intensive origins of their food, to look around and see where this came from. Craft beer culture deliberately asks questions about how the ingredients exist and what they affect. Their integrity as producers and consumers of the of that good beer increasingly relies on the quality of the processes and ingredients, how they came to be. That kind of meaning-making derives from an intimate awareness of the knowledge of the food which we consume and makes individuals feel more confident in their own relationship to what they eat, what they choose to do with their money that they spend on food. You see this in other food communities, too. Craft beer is not the only example. It's just the one I know really well. Where consumers of gourmet dinners or local wine, cheese, produce, all begin asking questions about how the process came to be that they got the food they had. And the intimacy and ethical connection to the process is part of what makes the consumer feel aligned with that food. They assess the quality and subsequent meaning of this food by relationship to its production. But what I think is really interesting about the craft beer community, it also relies heavily on stories other than its production. History and memory shape that community and offer a powerful model of how people use heritage to create meaning from their foods. For brewing communities, the place of beer and wine in human history creates a confidence in their practices and ties them to a deep-seated cultural value and spiritual mythologies. Historically, humans have brewed alcohol for over 30,000 years. It's one of the first technologies that we can identify in agriculture. And it's offered one of the first motivations for... And that started with the fermentation of honey into honey wine or meads. Increasingly, archaeological evidence also suggests that beer, only about 10,000 years old, offered one of the first motivations for human civilization to embark on the agricultural revolution, because you need to grow a lot of grains to make a lot of beer. Almost every major culture throughout the world, both in the new and old worlds, have alcoholic beverages fermented through some type of brewing process using different sugars from fruits to grains to honey, combined with the local wild yeast to change the to create alcohol. More importantly, almost all of these cultures also tell a mythological story of how that culture came upon their fermented beverage, giving it some type of spiritual and community meaning, connecting humans with their history and their environments. Across cultures, these myths explore the mystery of yeast turning sugar into alcohol, but also the unique effects of the alcohol has on the human body in creating mental and physical change. These are important to those stories. Thus, most traditional myths and cultures see alcohol beverages, like other foods central to their traditions and their survival, as connections to nature and the miracles created by life and the natural systems that surround our experience as human beings. More than larger mythologies, though, Food's historical meaning often shapes our personal connections to our surroundings and communities. For example, last summer when we went to Boulder, Colorado, we met a man from Cheyenne, Wyoming, who made his own mead, or honey wine, so that old, old process. For him, mead making was not only for producing alcohol, but connected him to a culture of honor associated with the historical Vikings. When we talked, he spoke of how Viking mead halls relied on an ethical code in which men were encouraged to consume alcohol responsibly while relaxing and contributing to the values of their community. But as soon as a drinker became a social hindrance, drinking too much, not learning when to pull the plug on his drinking endeavors, would be punished. For the man we met in Boulder, Colorado, that history helped him define his own ethics and relationships to a larger community. His approach to that heritage, he saw that heritage as a way in which to confirm his own practices, to feel confident in the communities that he participated in, and to extend kind of a older culture, a heritage, a meaning. This kind of, his approach to this heritage might seem a little arcane. It requires a lot of knowledge of history in the past. It's looking pretty far back and in a very different place. And a little extreme. But he found himself invested in historical symbols to contextualize his own identity. This kind of historical contextualization happens everywhere in craft beer culture. If you pay attention to bottle labels, craft beer often has historical images, mythological symbols, or references in popular cultural works, which align the drinkers and the drinks with larger cultural context. And I'd invite you to go just browse the labels. They're really interesting and fascinating and exciting, really neat pieces of art. Again, this hardly differs from the kinds of symbolism we bring to other kinds of food. For example, the farm on every Pepperidge Farm product, which I'm sure you're familiar with, right? Was a property owned by the original founders of the brand, but was never actually part of the corporation's food production. Nor would you expect to see it amongst its current corporate holdings, nor would you see a similar farm anywhere in what they're producing. Instead of being a real part of their process, we allow that symbol to communicate part of the food's meaning, associating those foods with the heritage of early American farmers, with big red barns, family farms, and a hardworking American tradition. Thus, as with the mead maker in Colorado, or how we see the Pepperidge Farm brand, food heritage offers one of the tools for which meaning becomes associated with food. These symbols dictate how we consume and see food, in turn contextualizing the values that we assign to it. Similarly, many cultural myths about food go beyond symbolism, exploring practices which shape our communal activities. Take, for example, Johnny Appleseed, or the Thanksgiving feast. Each offers us a connection to our past, to a wilderness settled by Europeans, or a unification of peoples who often were in conflict. And in doing so, they radically redefine the apple and the turkey within our cultural consciousness. Moreover, when we decide that Thanksgiving needs to be about buttered toast, popcorn, and jelly beans, as Snoopy and Charlie Brown did, we translate the meaning of one tradition into another. Thanksgiving, even if it doesn't involve a turkey, asks that everyone come together for a meal governed by sharing, hope, and the willingness to give thanks. Other meaning in food cultures can rely more on the spatial context in which we consume or produce the food. I want to return to the word local, which Sarah and I found to be particularly prominent in our experience of the Harrisonburg food culture. The word local helped us look at our food for its value as a reminder of our participation in a particular place, in a particular moment, in that particular community. When we bought foods labeled local, we consciously thought about our current space and its environment to better understand our food. When we saw local, we asked questions about the meaning our food made. Food gained meaning because of how it helped us feel connected to our place, where we were, our community, our context. Sometimes food isn't about the local place, though. It transports us to spaces outside of our current context, evoking meaning from other cultures and traditions of food. For example, if we go to a Mexican restaurant, the food becomes intertwined with the idea of Mexico. And often the draperies of the restaurant ask us to allow the food to transplant our thoughts to a place where the food was derived, that original location. We saw elements of that drapings last night at the, for those of you who attended the winter dinner, right? The decorations and activities transported us to experience of a place of fiestas and Latin dance, an exotic other place that we wanted to be, feel affiliated with. Such re-emplacing actions contribute to our commitment to cultures beyond ourselves, to places far away and exotic, to places that add extra meaning to our context. However, last night's event provided an additional meaning underneath the drapings and delicious Mexican food. The efforts of the social community and our gathering here in the building reminded us of our local community, coming together to share in the abundance that we have. The beauty of food and eating in general relies on its communal effort. Eating food offers one of the most cooperative activities of our daily lives. I'd like to return to the quote that Tom offered us at the beginning of service from Vanita Shiva, because I think her perspective on this intense cooperation helps us really understand our food. First, she describes food as part of creation's great foundations, relying on a vast network of organisms and systems created by time. She says, "The food we eat, the food that nourishes us, is a gift from the earth, from the sun, from the millions of years of evolution. A long chain back to the origin story is implied in our food," for her. But she then turns to all the links in the chain beyond that long chain back. It's also a gift from the farmers, livestock herders, fisher folk who tilled the land, cared for the animals, and harvested the fish. When we forget the earth from where we received our food, food becomes unsustainable. Food is life. Food is not just our vital need. It is the web of life. The long chain from sun to plants to soil, bacteria, farmer, food distributor, food processor, and food eater, and then the long chain of subsequent participants following our act of eating, keeps food alive. Unless you are a farmer or a gardener, a large portion of what you eat relies on a long chain of actors who made that food possible. And when we are aware of these actors, the food gains an ecological meaning, well beyond just our individual bodies. More than just our context and place, place becomes intertwined with our larger social, ecological, and communal context. By creating co-ops, farmers' markets, and opportunities to visit farms and work with them, physically, mentally, emotionally, we're reminded of the place and the long chain of communal connections that in which we live now. When food comes from local people in a local community, we're reminded how people are affected by the economy around us, how the landscape is altered by the farming practices, and how the ecology of our foods relies on all of nature's wonders, including birds and bees and the bacteria in the soil. Food's meaning becomes dependent on our surroundings. Though we have touched on cultural context, stories, and places that shape food's meaning, we still haven't explored a very important part of food, our bodies. Food sits at the foundation of Maslow's hierarchy of needs. We can't avoid food in our lives. At the most basic level, food provides the physical necessity of energy and facilitates the thousands, if not millions, of chemical processes within our bodies. Our experience as embodied beings, as beings that can know our bodies and use those bodies to interact with the world around us, is dictated by food. Every choice we make about eating radically changes how our bodies experience the world around us. Moreover, the meaning of food becomes, because of this, becomes more than a social instrument, but also shapes how we physically relate to the world. The first embodied experience that everyone shares in life is hunger. From the beginning, babies desire food. From that moment, this physical demand haunts our existence and becomes a metaphor for our desires and our needs. We feel hunger and we search around ourselves for nourishment. And that nourishment changes our relationships to our bodies. Hunger creates weakness, and then eating creates strength. As we saw in the reading of The Very Hungry Caterpillar by Melissa, food becomes a catalyst. Oh, thank you very much. It was great reading. The kids enjoyed it. Food becomes a catalyst for changing our bodies, both growing and shaping how we act and look and perform as holistic individuals. Once we begin to eat, food provides volumes of sensory feedback, and our responses to that feedback radically changes its meaning. Now, I have a little participatory activity, so I'm going to ask my helpers, so Tom and Sarah, they're going to pass around bowls of raisins. And what I want to do is I want to explore the place of our senses and their associated thoughts in changing our well-being by having you grab a few raisins. Don't eat them yet, though. Hold on to them. Do not eat yet. We'll eat them in a few moments. Hopefully there's enough to go around. There's lots of bowls. So what I'm going to ask you to do is if you hold on to those raisins, keep one or two in your hands, I'm going to walk us through a brief guided meditation about this food that is in front of you. I want you to examine your thoughts and how they connect to the sensory experiences that are part of eating. So does everyone have raisins? Almost. Yeah. Try not to grind them into the carpet. Sugary carpet's great for bugs. Okay. So first, I'd like you to take the raisins and place them out on your hand. Look at them. The first sense in which we experience food is sight. We see the food and we're reminded of a history we have with that food. We choose whether or not that's the thing we're going to reach out and eat. So just for a moment, I want you to meditate or focus on the memories that this raisin offers to you. How does it shape your relationship to this food? Now that you've seen that meaning, the food that how that meaning happens visually, I want you to place the raisin on your tongue. And just for a moment, don't chew on it yet. Just let it sit there. Feel the texture of the raisin. Examine how its shape and taste tell you what you're about to consume. Now, closing your eyes, I'd like you to chew that raisin and whatever other ones you have in your hand. Seeing how you, as you chew, feel how your teeth masticate the food, how it grinds it, how it makes it into smaller chunks. And feel how saliva breaks down that food, becomes a conduit for taste, for the feeling that's on your tongue. Now I'm going to ask you to swallow that food. As the food travels down your esophagus and eventually into your stomach, I want you to think about how it nourishes and acts upon your body in this moment. How that raisin becomes a source of change. And more than the change in yourself, include the millions of symbiotic microbes living in your gut. Think about the ecosystem that you are feeding right now with that raisin. Think how eventually the food will also feed other living beings outside your body. As it decomposes, it nourishes, it gives power, it returns energy to the land. Moreover, still thinking about the raisin, thinking about its place, why don't you imagine the land, the original place in which that raisin was grown, the long rows of grapevines on a California hill, sunny summer breeze. in that moment, that raisin, and all of the sensory experiences you just had, connected you to the world around us. It had all kinds of meaning. I ask you to look for that meaning. While this meditation may seem a little weird, it's clear how sensory experiences shape our meaning. So I'm done with the meditation, if you want to eat raisins and open eyes and stuff. Such embodied experiences change how we interpret and act upon our surroundings and we engage with other beings. If the food tastes or looks or smell good, we give a compliment to the cook and we deliberately consume the food, thinking of all the processes that came together to make it so delicious. Oh, sugar. Awesome. Right? If any of the senses reject the food, we stick out our tongues and feel revolted by it, throwing it away for some other creature to have, not frequenting that restaurant again, right? We create habits of mind and memory that transform our food's meaning. For example, the food that reminds us of our grandma's cooking may bring us good feelings that will bring us back to that food over and over again. While the food that reminds us of the time we got food poisoning or had a little bit too much fun at a college party will be something we avoid for the rest of our lives. These become incredibly instinctual. We continue to react to that food through the rest of our lives, altering each and every eating experience from that moment forward. Of course, once past the mouths and our stomach, food also becomes absorbed in our bodies and interacts with us constantly, helping lubricate our body processes. If we eat the wrong thing, our intestines will become uncomfortable. If we eat too much, we fall asleep. Or we eat too little and we become ravenous, maybe even resorting to hostility if we cannot access enough food within our immediate environment. Our interactions with our surroundings through our bodies depends on relinquishing control of food by eating. We let go. Once in our digestive tract, food acts upon our bodies, changes our chemical processes. Moreover, once out of our control, food also becomes sustenance for other beings both within and without our bodies. Increasingly, scientists are finding that millions of bacteria in our gut that eat the food we consume guide our connection to life. Food changes how these gut bacteria interact with us and affect our bodies in many ways. For example, some studies are finding that high densities of certain strains of gut bacteria can affect our ability to lose weight or the attitudes that we have to the people around us. Increased negativity or increased positivity just based on the cultures of bacteria in our gut. The interior ecology plays as much a role as the food's meaning as the exterior ecology, that long chain of origin points from which our food derives. So clearly, having kind of explored all these different points and these intersections, played with food for a little bit, there are many contexts through which food creates meaning in our lives. We have seen our food as both heritage and symbol that can bridge communities and pull together individuals in common purpose. We have explored how our food grounds us in a particular physical space and in the functioning of our bodies. And in doing so, we have explored how our food provides a basic need while connecting mentally and physically the processes facilitated by the soil, the plants, humans, and other living beings to in the complicated process across vast ecologies that reach back thousands of years. I hope that in seeing all of these, we become more aware of how food acts as connective tissue in our lives. It's important if we are going to prosper as spiritual inquirers to account for the meaning of food in our lives, because it permeates every action, every day, and affects our relationship to every other part of our life. This being true, we should also work mindfully to cultivate a greater awareness of the meanings behind these actions. What meanings are created by our food? So as to understand the effects they can have on the local and global community and ecology. Food, in its most sacred and spiritual sense, intervenes continuously in the vast network of life. I know when we're playing with food today, we have made the plate, maybe the tablecloth, and even the walls a little bit messy. However, we can't tackle all of that mess at once. Instead, I would suggest you take small actions around your food to create more mindful changes and the awareness of how food affects you. I've offered a number of different ways in which I see meaning happening around what we eat, and I hope that you, in the next week or month or year, can spend some time exploring how food makes meaning in your own lives. Ask yourselves questions, and I think we're going to have a little bit of time for discussion, so you can also respond to these questions. Where do you see meaning come from food? How do you see food coming together in your own lives to create meaning, connection, spirituality? Thank you.
Okay, there's definitely time for discussion. And yes.
I'm Grace MacMillan. I moved to Wamego last July, so I've only been in the area for a while. And before then, I lived in Topeka, and it was a lot easier to feel connected to a local food community. I could ride my bike to farmers market. My next door neighbors had chickens. I was part of a group of urban homesteaders of Topeka. Everyone had a garden. Everyone baked. It was just like what you guys described, like so much about food. My friends taught fermenting classes, and it was amazing. And now I'm in a place where I don't even want to use the local grocery store because of the prices. And, you know, I find that food has just become a chore, just something to, you know, a way to feed my family, and I don't have local connections. And it's until you did this program, I didn't realize like how much I was missing all of that and how much it was a part of my daily life, and I took it for granted. And thank you for bringing it back into focus for me so I can, you know, try to make connections. I'll probably talk to you soon.
Yeah. Well, it's been kind of a rude shock because we were at undergrad, so we were in like school bubble and food bubble around Harrisonburg, and we came here and all of a sudden we have full-time jobs and lots of other contexts, and the food meaning here is different. So yeah, it's great for sharing.
Okay, it's Kathleen Tenona. Thanks, this is near and dear to my heart, and I just have fallen in love in Kansas with the availability of becoming a locavore, basically. And I have lots of sources if anybody's interested. I picked up a bag of spinach, kale, escarole, and salad mix from my local source just the other day, and it feels great.
Yeah.
So, thanks.
That's excellent that you have the community. We're finding we're having to do a lot more searching here than we had to. And
I just wanted to put a plug in. You've been here a couple of years, so maybe you've heard of it, but the Manhattan Community Gardens.
Yes.
Okay.
Yeah.
It certainly has connected me to this space and to the earth and to a large community of in general, like-minded people. And there are quite a few members of the community gardens in this fellowship, which is nice. Sylvia has been there how many years? 20-some years.
Yeah.
And also in Wamego, well, I'm sure Kathleen will tell you all about the places, but the daughter of one of our members has an organic farm out there. She supplies people's groceries, and I imagine she sells locally. Yeah? So thank you for this, you know, interesting topic. I have an extreme sense of it is a spiritual feeling when I can prepare a meal that is 100% out of my garden. And I try to do that often during the summertime.
Anna Franklin. So I just want to say this is a great and very important discussion. Thank you so much for this talk. And I also want to say that because we're a smaller community, Grace, it takes more work to pull together around local foods, organic foods, and the things that we know we need to really live a quality life through food and community. So the farmers market, of course, but also the community gardens are wonderful here. It just takes a while to, you know, get to know where everything is. So, thank you.
Yeah, speaking to the getting to know, we're starting to build habits and find friends. Something about Harrisonburg. Like, we knew what restaurants to go to ask where the suppliers were. Yeah. Yeah, well, and so it's just, it's an interesting shift and change.
Sylvia.
Oh, it does take a little while to make your connections. And is your name Grace? You live right near this Paradiesa Farms. They deliver eggs to my door. The two different bison people deliver meat to my door if I want them to. I mean, you can get a lot of stuff like that. And you can have your own garden. I mean, even if you... Yeah, I mean, to me, that's my salvation and my psychiatrist and just everything. That opens everything to you. And our member, the Campbells, Matt Campbell, built a brick oven in his backyard, and he was hoping to develop this bread-baking community, and none of his neighbors ever even asked him what he was doing. But we, luckily, are two of his neighbors, and my husband's gone several times and helped him bake bread, and so he does that periodically, and it's just wonderful. And it takes all day. You have to feed the stove, and then there's all the wonderful stuff that comes out of it, and also the community. And thanks, Alex, for a wonderful, well-put-together, and very interesting talk.
Thank you.
I was just going to say where I get my eggs sometimes. But... June.
Hi, I'm June Kempthorne. We were back to the land hippies, and so we have an orchard that's 40 years old. And I was just looking at our ducks and chickens this morning. They were having so much fun in the sun. And those types of things have ruled our lives. And the animals give you so much love. We don't eat them, but we enjoy their eggs, and they're so yellow from the ripe things to eat that they just pop up in your skillet and say, good morning. It's a treat that I wouldn't give up for $1 million. So here's to the farm.
Amen to that.
All right.
I wanted to share that part of what creates meaning for me with food is thinking about the people that grow it and harvest it and process it for us. And I want to share a little story about Rod, Rhonda's partner, and the lambs that they raise. I'll try not to make it too wordy here, but as context, I had a formative experience of working on organic farms in California as a teenager, and that's where I learned from my mentors that the American desire not to pay for food, right, to pay just pennies for anything, is actually one of the greatest enemies to having good organic food. And it's a huge impact upon the people who produce our food. So coming back full circle to Paradiesa, Rhonda shared an email, maybe it was last year, about the way that Rod cares for the lambs that they grow. And in this email, she talked about him using his knowledge from his years and his life in Iraq in the blessings and the selections that he makes of lambs for harvest. And I believe he even accompanies these lambs to slaughter to comfort them. And that was so incredibly moving to me as a story of caring and comfort dealing with lambs. I know it sounds a little scary too, Shirley, but it was really moving and wonderful to me. And it made me probably a forever orderer of a quarter lamb from Rod and Rhonda. Not that I'm advertising for them today.
I really appreciated your talk because it made me remember memories of my own connected with food and how important food often is in building friendships and building relationships. I'd make bread when my children were young. My wife makes carrot ginger soup that I enjoy. I take my family out to lunch, and maybe I don't even hear the conversation, but it's wonderful to share that. And then with friendships, that having someone to supper is just a way. It's an important way that we say we're friends. We are important to each other. So, thank you.
Yeah. Where? Oh, yeah. But we're still online, right? Anything else? Does anybody know what the A and P is? Show of hands. Okay. Because when it was the only grocery store my mother could go to for years, and she went to the farmer's market on every other Saturday. Anyway, we have a few closing things. Thanks, Alex.
Yeah.
Okay, turn in your hymnal to the whatever Dick's going to lead.
134. And stand, please.
And sing. So as we close, with faith in the creative powers of life, with hope for the future of life in this world, with love for all others who share this life with us, let us go forward together in peace. Our meeting has ended. Let our service begin.